An exceptionally interesting and troubling book has come my way, as I'm sure it has come the way of many other readers. It's by Helen Smith, who is a practitioner of the profession that I more or less have practiced through a long career, namely psychology. And she is the author of a new book titled Men on Strike, with a very startling and meaningful subtitle, Why Men Are Boycotting Marriage, Fatherhood, and the American Dream, and Why It Matters. Are men indeed boycotting marriage, fatherhood, and the American dream?
First of all, hi, Mr. Rosenberg, and thank you so much for having me on your wonderful podcast today.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
Sure. I think they are. And one of the things that got me thinking about this is that they actually had there was actually a study done, and they found that men are much more likely to say that getting married is not that important to them anymore, whereas women are more likely to say now that getting married is much more important. And that was a Pew Research study that was done last year. And there's a big discrepancy now. And so you have to ask, what is it about men that makes them opt out? Well, I read up on a lot of books like The End of Men by Hannah Rawson, or Manning Up, or Save the Mills by Catherine Parker. And the basic message in those books is that men are acting immaturely, that men don't want to get married because they're just immature, you know, guys, sort of like the Tucker Max types.
Yes, another one who wrote such a book is Kay Heimowitz, I believe.
Yes, and that was called Manning Up, exactly.
Yeah.
And she says, she has a chapter in there called Child Man in the Promised Land, talking about how men are sort of immature. And so this is sort of a response to all of that. And my point in the book, Men on Strike, is that men are acting rationally because the rewards for men in the fields of marriage, education, careers, and fatherhood, it's a lot less than it used to be, and the costs and dangers are much higher. So many men are opting out. And they're doing what I term going galt. I mean, that's obviously, if you read Ayn Rand, you sort of understand that option of just saying, you know what, I'm not going to produce anymore. I'm not going to get involved in a system that basically has me producing and doing things. And I think a lot of men feel like they're sort of being extracted for resources through marriage. And indeed, in some sense, in today's society, they really are.
Well, I'm in the business of being a man, and I have been for rather a long, long time, and married and have children and so on. But you're saying that if I were starting in the game right now, the incentive array in front of me would look different.
Yes, I think they would. And I talked to a lot of guys in their 20s and 30s, and a lot of them feel differently. And in fact, the men who have been divorced, many of those men don't want to get married. What's even more interesting is some of the studies they've done show that men between the ages of 30 and 50, it's something like 25% or more of those men never want to get married. So it's even sort of the older age groups. But the younger guys, they're sort of a little bit more wise. And I think one reason for that is, you know, back when maybe you were getting married, there wasn't as much divorce. I think guys look around and they see their dad or their uncle or brother or somebody, older brother, you know, getting divorced and seeing what these guys are going through. And they're starting to understand how the cards are stacked against them in marriage.
I'm so senior that I think possibly I married before no-fault divorce was widely established. Well, when, in fact, did that come on the horizon, and what has it done?
Well, no-fault divorce, I guess that happened, when was that? Probably in the 80s, 70s, 80s.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, definitely, I think what's happened is a lot of women now, it doesn't matter what you do in a marriage, there's no weighing of, you know, if somebody cheated or really what happened. And people say, well, it's no fault, they'll just walk away. But what's happened is we've sort of kept the older, you know, laws in place for men, where men pay the majority of the alimony. In other words, men are still paying something like 90-something percent of the alimony. They're still only getting children in something like 14% of the cases. So I think part of the problem is that society has adjusted to give women more rights in marriage. But at the same time, men have fewer rights, or they have the same rights, but they're expected to do more. So it's sort of a transitional type thing.
Well, let's look at some of the other disincentives, because yours is really an incentive analysis. And though there are some gains in marriage, and there are some gains in taking on sort of the masculine role and being a good father and a good provider and working hard and et cetera, you seem to be suggesting that the gains are not as evident or as sizable as they used to be, and the negative consequences grow increasingly visible and increasingly punishing. Let's look at the whole group of related incentives, both positive and negative.
Well, I mean, I think in a certain sense, you know, people say that people are happier when they're married. Yes, they are happier when they're married, for men particularly. However, it's only if they have a good marriage, and more men are feeling that maybe their marriage isn't the best. And I think part of the problem is that there's no incentive from society. It used to be if you were a good provider, you were told, you know, oh, that's really great, or you were given like some, it was seen as sort of a positive. You were seen as a grown up. And now if you're a provider, that puts you in a kind of a precarious situation where you're providing, but if anything goes wrong with the marriage, because you've been a provider, now you're going to be paying either alimony or more child support. So it isn't always an advantage, and you may not even get your kids. Years ago, this was in the like 19th century up until early 20th, we had what was called coverture, which was the old English law that said that the marriage was subsumed, the legal rights were subsumed by the man. But now it seems that coverture is subsumed, those legal rights are held in the woman's hands, and indeed men have fewer rights to their kids than they used to. It used to be the kids, which was also unfair, you know, more or less belonged, if you want to say, to the man. Well, now those kids almost always exclusively seem to belong to the woman, or at least in the court of law, men are less likely to get those kids. But I guess if you want to go back to it and look at, you know, what are the psychological reasons in marriage that are positive and negative? I mean, you can think, obviously, the happiness factor if you do have a good marriage, but there's also the negative side of many men in marriages now. Because of the culture, a lot of women won't allow men, for example, to see their friends. Men who are married tend to see friends less. And as a psychologist, you can certainly understand that if men see their friends less, are not able to go out as much, are not able to do some of those old things they used to do, like go to the Elks Club, go be with male friends. Now we discourage that because our society says it's not safe for men to get together.
I must tell you about something I saw on television literally only, I think, two nights ago. Mm-hmm. I had been reading your book, and this struck me as virtually talismanic of the altered scene concerning male and female privilege and male and female power. The scene is five or six women, well accoutred in sort of tailored clothing, are standing there, and one rather slender man is standing at the far end of the array of people, and they're talking to an attractive young woman who is selling them something from AT&T. It had something to do with web services, and they at first seem skeptical. The woman who's doing most of the responding says, well, why this, why that? She's asking questions, and then she says, aha, okay, I've got it, and we'll go with you. You've got us. And all the other women cross their arms and say, we're with you, you've got us. And the little man standing at the far end looks confused and then crosses his arms later than do the other women and sort of nods and says, I've never seen anything that's more of a willful and even intended testament to male inefficiency and insignificance in the business world. Now, I don't know who did the ad. Probably some very important advertising company, and probably it's going to be quite successful in selling whatever it was AT&T was selling with regard to web services. But it's, as I say, it seems to me talismanic of what a representation of that ad, as I've just described.
Yes, I totally get it. And I think that what you're seeing is this is very common in the media world, that we see men who look very insignificant and women are seen as being very big, very powerful, very strong.
But then they're doing it in other ads as well, are they?
Oh, it's in many ads. In fact, there's one ad called it something about the doghouse, where JCPenney had an ad where if men didn't buy the woman the right present, he was sent to a doghouse to be punished. And all the other men, there were a bunch of men down in this doghouse where they were sort of living in, I guess, in hell or something. And this is very common. In fact, there's a professor called Jim McNamara, and he's actually out of Sydney, Australia. And he wrote a book, a great book called Media and Male Identity. And in that book, he found through his research that 69% of the portrayals of men in the media are negative, like what you just saw, are showing men. They either show men as perverts, ineffectual, you know, just some negative message about men. So it's very common. And he found that only 12% of messages about men in the media were positive. And that's very, very low. And what we hear from women is, oh, well, women are portrayed in the media such and such. But what we, you know, and maybe sometimes women are portrayed negatively in the media, but it's far, far less than the negative way that men are portrayed.
I think one has to ask what the relation of all that's in your book is to something that happened in our society a number of decades ago and has grown in force and in spread. And that is the so-called feminist revolution or the feminist movement. Hath feminism wrought its masterpiece in making males less likely to marry, to be interested in fatherhood, to work hard, and so on? Is feminism, in essence, anti-male?
I don't think it's meant to be in essence. And in fact, there's an excellent piece by Michael Higdon, who's a family law professor, that looks at the very issues you're talking about. And he talks about feminism relating to male reproductive rights. And he said, if women have the right to autonomy to their own bodies, then so should men. And if you are a true feminist, then you would believe that both sexes should have autonomy, because that's ultimately, you know, in the United States of America, that's ultimately, you know, we believe in autonomy over one's body. But is feminism, you know, people always want to completely blame feminism for what's going on. And I think, yes, in some sense, it's partly to blame. But there are also what I call in the book these white knight types. And men are very much to blame, because men will go along with this whole chivalrous act. Men are either feminists like the women, and they go along with whatever they say because they're trying to get women, or they want to seem politically correct. And those are more people in the liberal sort of political, you know, spectrum. And then on the other side, you've sort of got the conservative group who are white knighting men, who say, oh, you know, women have to be protected, or women can't make their own decisions, or we have to make sure that women get the child support, that women get all the help that they need. So you've kind of got these two groups, and they're both sort of working on the same side of the fence, you know, and the people who are politically correct kind of do go along with the feminists. So I think it's the feminists in cahoots with the higher level politicians. For example, somebody, you know, politicians know today, I mean, or even academics, look at Larry Summers. What's going to happen if you go against the feminist grain? Well, you could lose your job. You could lose your election. You know, I think the fact that so many women vote, and so many of those women do tend to be more liberally oriented, or even those women who are conservative tend to be more for women's rights, in the sense that, you know, they think women should get child support. They think women deserve alimony. They think that women need to, you know, be protected. But at the same time, these women also, yes, they think that, you know, women are supposed to make as much as men for doing, working less hours. They're supposed to have, you know, child services wherever they work, you know, care for their children. So if they want to make a decision about child care, they want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to go to work like a man, but they also want the job to be able to take care of them in a way. And now what they're doing is they're turning to the government. So the government, in some sense, is helping women to opt out of having a husband at all, because women tend to, especially women who don't make much money, tend to use the government and get more subsidies if they are not married. And even if they have children out of wedlock, the state will force the man to pay the child support, and at the same time provide them with things like women and infant, you know, and children, the WIC or SNAP or one of the welfare services. So
I have read one or two conservative commentators who suggest that essentially the kind of government we have now is anti-family. Family gets in the way. It's another resource, another source of power or organization or influence. And citizens are best rendered pliable to governmental use and governmental planning for their supposed welfare if they are not involved in family itself. Does that seem to you sort of a hidden function that is being served?
Yes, I think there is a partial truth to that. And if you look at even at Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, when you look at who is buying that, it's mostly young single women. That's the majority of people buying the care, supporting that sort of thing. So yes, when you don't have families, you have units of people, and people who are single, especially women, are much more likely to vote for liberal politicians because they need the help, they want the help. And so, yeah, there are all these forces playing together. It's a combination of sort of feminism, the sort of politically correct atmosphere. And even at the same time, it's not like conservatives are that much better on it. I saw some article a while back by Bill Bennett, I think it was. And, you know, everybody, that side of the spectrum is always telling men to man up and go ahead, and just, you know, be the provider, do all of these things. But what they don't realize is if men are not getting anything out of this situation, if they are not being provided with, used to, they did get a lot of respect. Society respected you. You had more access, you know, to the family. We even have what I call in the book, and Brett McKay, who writes a blog, wrote about this, but the decline of male space, where we just don't even want men. Men, when they get married, a lot of times are relegated to this man cave. I don't know if you have one, but, you know, it's down in the basement somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's the dirtiest part of the house. The man's given the garage or the basement, and sure, they all say they like it. But I've seen a number of men where the minute the woman leaves the house or something, he's right upstairs or he's not out in that garage anymore. You know, once the guy gets divorced or has his own house, a lot of times he likes to spend time up in the family room or somewhere else. So I think there's almost this relegation of men aren't really part of the family. Let's kind of exclude the men, get rid of them.
You assert, and indeed you marshal some statistics in support of the assertion in Men on Strike, that men are striking not only against or so distancing themselves from family and from wooing and wedding and so on, but also that they show somewhat less strong motivation in work, or careerist activism is floundering just a bit. Some are certainly capable of it, but lots of men kind of go for an easier solution, lower pay, lower professional skill, and would rather hoist one at the bar with the boys than spend a serious day at work. Am I characterizing your impression accurately?
I think that's part of it, but I think a lot of guys are going gold. And what I think we have to realize is a lot of men aren't taking a traditional path. Those men are not going to college as often, and we are seeing those college stats.
Yeah.
And I know you were talking to John Leo a while back. I heard a podcast that you did with
him. Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you all were talking about the decline of men going to college. And that's something he writes about in Minding the Campus. And I think that's the case. I think that men are finding these traditional paths to be kind of anti-male and not conducive to the types of things they want to do. For example, if you're a guy and you want to go into college and you find out it's sort of this politically correct place where you're supposed to take women's studies, it makes it a lot more difficult, and a lot of guys are going into more vocational, traditional places.
I ran a doctoral program in the psychology department of the University of Chicago, doctoral program in social psychology, and I ran it for a number of years. I emeritized a few years ago, but it was discernible that we had, over, say, a 20-year period or so, decrease in number of male applications, increase in number of female applications.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, I think it's gone up with psychology, PhD, something like 70-30 now. It's really high.
And you are a female PhD in psychology.
Exactly. I do more forensic work, and I find in that there's a few more males, of course. But when I was certainly in clinical and school psychology, we certainly had more women. Those stats are changing. You can kind of see why they're changing, because I think there's been a whole turn to feminizing a lot of these humanities. And also the pay level. I think when women enter a field, unfortunately, women don't fight for more pay.
What do you mean by feminizing the humanities?
Well, I think that we have this whole attitude, you know, even when you go into class, even when I was in school, and I was in graduate school in the 80s and early 90s, and even when I was there, it's really kind of an anti-male scene where we talk a lot about politically correct things, where men really aren't allowed to speak up in the classes, and they want everybody to be feminist, and they have certain ideas and things that you must have. And in fact, there are some graduate doctoral programs in counseling or clinical psych, mainly counseling, where if you don't hold certain politically correct views, they're not going to allow you to get in. And what they call it is they guide it under social justice. But I think when social justice has come in, where everybody has to have the same type of political views, it's much more fitting, because it's much more about the collective. And I think women tend to, now this, I'm stereotyping here, women tend to be more collectivist, men tend to be more individualistic. But I think also when I talk to men about why they don't want to go into psychology, they say, I can't afford the pay cut. Women are willing to do things that they like, And maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. But I know when I was in school, this is terrible, but a lot of people would do a lot of stuff for free. I never could afford to do that because I had to pay for myself. So whenever I did internships, whenever I did anything, I had to find something that paid at least some kind of a stipend or some amount of money. And I was constantly being told that you're supposed to be doing it out of the goodness of your heart. And I was like, I'm here for the money. I'm not here out of the goodness of my heart. I mean, I was just that blunt about it. And I would really get looks of disgust. But sometimes I guess I was being a little, you know, facetious. But I do think that psychology has definitely turned it's pretty anti-male. And the other thing is, as you get more and more men don't want to go into a field when they don't see, you know, men there. They don't feel welcome. And I think the pay has a lot to do with it, too.
This is elaborated, as are many other important insights and important studies summarized in the book by Helen Smith, titled Men on Strike, subtitled Why Men Are Boycotting Marriage, Fatherhood, and the American Dream, and Why It Matters. That's published, by the way, by Encounter Books. I must compliment you on the vigorous writing. It's very readable, and it presents a lot of material that might be difficult statistically, but you render it quite available and quite easy to comprehend because you know how to turn statistics into real facts and into real prose. So I compliment you on all of that. But I do want to ask you about fatherhood, which is in your subtitle. The fact is that we have a decline, even in this society, the kind of decline we see much more fully in Western Europe right now, in birth rates. Italy is as low as 1.2 children born per couple. Ireland is about 1.3, a Catholic country of all places. Germany similarly. France similarly. We are now about 2.0, but that's only if you count the Hispanic and the black populations. If you count the non-Hispanic, non-black, we are down to around 1.8 and going down, which suggests that somebody in those couples isn't wanting to go forward to have children, whether it's mothers or fathers. And you suggest in your subtitle that men are boycotting fatherhood. Do we have evidence that they are the let's have no kids or let's have fewer kids party in the bargain?
Yeah, I mean, I do think men are having fewer kids because they realize that the kid belongs to the mother now. I think because of this sort of unwritten rule of coverture that we have today, that men realize, you know what, I'm not going to be that active. And I do invest in the kids. Like everyone says, get involved in fatherhood. You know, we've got all these, especially politically, they're always talking about, like, we'll have a fatherhood initiative. But you have to, if you feel like you're going to be a father, but that you could lose anything, any time that you say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing, or, you know, the law doesn't protect you. And I think men know this. And people say to me, well, men, especially younger men, aren't going to realize this. And they're going to, you know, that couldn't enter into it. But I've been on radio shows and I've talked to men across the country, and I beg to differ because all of them tell me I definitely understand the risk. And I think men do want children, but I think that they feel that the children are not going to be theirs. I think they feel that they really belong to the mother. And so I do think there are fewer men who want to be involved. And I think they want to be involved much less because I think they feel, you know, that they aren't needed as often. If you look, there was, I believe it was in England where the birth rate was really going down. And there was some newspaper that I quoted in a book, and they went on about how it was the men's fault because men didn't want children, and women, you know, a lot of women want a husband and want a father, and men don't want to get married and they don't, you know, want to have the kids. But the thing is, they don't look at what's happened to the men over time and how so many men have been screwed by the system, and how many younger men are coming in and seeing what's happened to those men and how they've been treated. And, you know, and I think we're going to see, unless we turn the tides, I think we're going to see fewer and fewer men want to be fathers and want, you know, yes, do men want to be fathers? Yes, indeed they do. But I think they realize that this, you know, I think they realize what's going on right now. And I think also what we were talking about before, the government plays a big part, particularly in those lower socioeconomic, those men are having fewer kids. And in fact, the lower socioeconomic men, those men making less money are getting married much less often, which sounds strange, but it's more the college educated men and women who are getting together and getting married more often now, because they've got the finances to do so. And college educated men, I think, don't feel that it's stacked against them, because maybe they feel like they maybe have resources that other men may not have.
So men on strike are not only American men. This is true. Is it throughout the Western world?
Other men tell me such, and men, I know in the England, they have problems there. There are many fewer men. The birth rate is definitely going down. Obviously, you talk about Italy, and in the book, I talk about sort of a metaphor for the Concordia, which was an Italian ship.
Yes,
yeah. Where all the men just abandoned, sort of, they jumped off ship first and left the women and children. They were even pushing them. And I think this is a microcosm, a metaphor for what our society has become like. Men have just stopped being chivalrous, and you can sort of see why. It's like going back to sort of feminism and just the political laws. Men are so afraid of being charged with sexual harassment or just harassment in general that they've kind of stopped acting like men. And you can understand that. Say you hold the door open for a woman, and the next thing you know, she's brought, you know, you're being told that you're sexist.
Yes, yes, indeed. I know the time is short. Last and basic question. Mm-hmm. And I draw the question directly from the works of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, who titled one of his pamphlets simply and directly, "What is to be done?" Is there anything to be done in this realm?
I absolutely believe there is a lot to be done. And I think the first thing that I talk about in the book is to men. I mean, I'm the book is written for men. It's written by me. And I guess being a woman, that makes it a little more difficult. But the book is written for men and it's telling men directly, stop letting women control the dialogue. When you hear women talking and saying negative things about men, you know, speak up. When you see these negative commercials and the culture treating men poorly, say something. And I've noticed more and more men doing that. They're getting on the internet. They're starting to set more boundaries and say, you know, I'm not going to put up with it anymore. The other thing is we need both grassroots organizations at the you know, state and local levels. We also need I really think that we need, and they are trying to get this, the White House Council for Boys and Men. Now, unfortunately, I worry a little bit about this because you worry about the political correctness of it. Are they going to try to turn men into just, you know, women? Or, you know, I don't really know, but I think that you need a definite group that lobbies. Nobody lobbies for boys and men. And we didn't even get into the whole thing about boys, but boys have many issues between the schools who see their masculine behavior as a negative to, you know, into high school and college. And I really think that we need to go in and look at our education, our culture, and really start looking at how we can change the incentives and the laws and the culture to help men to be, you know, successful, just like we help women.
I must end by quoting Christina Hoff Summers' comment on your book. She's an old friend of mine who has been on the earlier radio program I did for many years. And she says, the patriarchy of feminist lore is in full retreat. 3 decades of media male bashing, father adverse family courts, and feminized classrooms have led millions of male hegemons to drop out from education, marriage, fatherhood, and even the workplace. In this riveting and eye-opening book, Helen Smith explains how it all happened, why it is harmful, and what can be done to turn things around. You do indeed, and I commend you for the book, Men on Strike, and I thank you very much, Helen, for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and thank you for all the work that you've done and are still doing.
It's my pleasure to talk with you. Goodbye for now.
Bye. Thank you.